the land of the Bible is our topic on the shelf today. If we flip back to the very end of our Bible, to those more colorful pages than the rest, we get a whole lot of maps, at least for the more inspired versions of the Bible. The more maps, the better the Bible. And we could well start, if we look at one of those maps, oftentimes we get the biggest map, or at least of the biggest view, looking at the journey of Abram, or the journey of the patriarchs, across the land. And it would look something to this effect. Do we get this journey from Ur, of the Chaldeans, or the Babylonians, up all the way to Haran, and then we'd have him coming down into the land of Canaan itself. We'd also see that he goes into the land of Egypt for a little while. There's various arrows on different maps. But as we look at the layout of the biblical map, we see the board that's beneath all of the stories that we read of. It helps to have a feel for how those pieces all fit together. So we could think of it really as just a biblical chessboard, as it were. You want to play the game well of chess, you get to know the board. You get to see how the pieces interact with one another. On the biblical playing board, the biblical landscape, what sort of regions are important? What sort of routes are important? Why do kings, princes, leaders of different nations make the moves that they do across the land? And how might that interact with the other decisions that are made? As we read through so much of the scriptures, we get the narrative of how it unfolded. And those questions can come to mind. Why do we know about a place like Hebron? What about the Oak of Mamre? What's the deal with that? But all of these different places that we get all over the Bible. So what do we deal with? How do we deal with them? If we were to kind of divide the biblical landscape into three rough portions, we kind of have the European front across the Mediterranean from Asia Minor and Greece. We have off to the east, Asia, with the spice trade that comes in from the desert lands over to the Orient further east. And we have Africa. We have the trade of gold and other resources coming from down south. And right at the intersection of these three major pieces of land is the land between, so it's been called. The land that's smack in the middle. The land that God promised to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, and that he brought them into by his faithfulness. Now, this map isn't just my consideration. If you look back even to a Crusader map, that was the way that they had depicted the comings and goings of the world. You have three rough portions. The ship sailing across the ocean. America, the new land, Terra Nova. You've got Anglica, or England, up there to the left. You have these pieces that fit together. But you've got Africa in the south, Europe off to the west, and Asia up to the east. And they all converge around, even as this map depicts, and was central to their thinking, Jerusalem, the land between. It all came together around this one spot in Jerusalem. And if we zoom in then on that land, and we think about all those big magnets, as it were, that drive travel and trade through the region, we see these major routes connecting major places. That's really, if we could sum up the rule of any landscape, the major routes connect major places. That is to say, even nowadays, where we have the technology to blaze through a mountain or two, if we make a freeway, it goes from a central city toward another central city, and the more important, the more traveled it is, the straighter and more direct we try to make it. The more lanes we would give it, the more heavily trafficked it becomes. And so we get from the west, from the Mediterranean, the sea, you get the ports that come in. All the trade. If you think of King Solomon bringing in the trees of Lebanon, bringing in the spices and all of the materials to make the temple, they come into the ports from all over and are taken down to Jerusalem. But then you also have this route going out to the spice trade of the Arabian Peninsula and the gold down in Egypt. These big cats on the playing board, if you would. There was someone who depicted it as though you have cats and mice running around the board. You have these bigger nations, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, out in their respective areas. And these little mice that are running around, kind of scurrying in between here in the hills, like Israel, like the Phoenicians, like the Philistines, and other Canaanite nations that are here in the middle. When the cats are away, so it says, the mice are at play. And so we see, when Egypt pulls out, they remove themselves from the land, we notice that there's more interactions between the Philistines out on the coast here, and Israel, which is up in the foothills. We see more interaction, we see more comings and goings. And they have their little skirmishes on their scales, while those big nations around them are traveling to and from and through this land between. So it's helpful to think of the interaction between those big players and the little guys. Oftentimes when we see the biblical map, this is a, you know, the typical layout that we get. And so we think all that was happening was just around Israel. That was the map. And yet in reality, we could turn back to the bigger map and see that's really just a junction of all these other nations passing through. When the patriarchs then came into the land, they didn't follow those big routes and settle down on the coastlands, like the Phoenicians, like the Philistines. They settled right up into the hills, as God had directed. Abram made his way down, and he came from up northeast, came down into the land, and he took the path along the hills. Here we have Shechem, that he set up an altar to God in praise of who God was. He continued down, went into Egypt, but then he came back up to Beersheba. He went past Hebron. There's Jerusalem. It's just a little reference point, that dot in the middle. So God's people had a place even tucked away there in the hills. As God brought his people out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery, he says to them, just before giving the Ten Commandments, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation. The songwriter puts it, he hideth my soul in the cleft of the rock that shadows a dry, thirsty land. All of these images of the desert, of the rocks that rose up against the landscape, towering from Egypt up into the Sinai Peninsula at the base of the land of Israel, God carried his people through. He tented with them in the wilderness. Here's a depiction of a Bedouin tent. This is down in Wadi Rum, which is in present-day Jordan, right around the southern border of where they would have come into the land, and a Bedouin tent, which even in the daytime, as you look up and you see the light trickling through the goat hairs up above, you see what looks as though stars fill the heavens above you, even in the daytime. Reminders of the promise that God had given to Abram. So shall your descendants be. Abram going from place to place, pitching his tent, living as a nomad. God provided for them. He tented in the wilderness with them. And where there was no food, he rained down bread from heaven every day that they were to collect. The bread of life that came down to sustain them. And when there was no water, he made water spring from the rock. In their most desperate areas, in their most desperate times, God filled their needs and sustained them. This is the Valley of Zin, which is right about where they were when they came to finding that they had no water. And here today, there's a spring that's still to be found there in the midst of that barren canyon. And you can see it still flowing forth with water today. Whether this was in fact the very spring, whether it was nearby, it's hard to say. But we see these springs in the desert that fill up. God was a good shepherd to them through this dry and barren land. And just think through how God brought them and where God brought them. Here's where they came, the logical flow of the land. God had promised them both land to the east and to the west of the Jordan River. They came from Egypt. They traveled up through the southern end. This doesn't work. Look, through the southern end, through Edom, the one kingdom. They had to go around. Edom wouldn't let them go through. Moab also said, you can't come through. So they went around Moab. They came up to the plains of Midian, up to Gilead. And they defeated the king of Bashan, Og, his name. Everything is larger than life out there. These flat volcanic plains that stretch up into the distance. Og with his, I can't remember how many foot or meter bed. I think it was a, what was it?
Nine foot,
so about 3 meters about bed. Massive thing. And his chariot that went out. So it's no small, everything is sort of larger than life. And the cows of Bashan is often an image that comes up, and we find still today cows grazing out there, just these massive bulls. I believe the psalmist uses it in Psalm 22, the bulls of Bashan, they surround them. And so then we get kind of this flow. All the colors are, it's just these prominent regions on the land, and the red regions are ones that are sort of contested by these other ones. So Damascus up to the north, will tend to move into Bashan. Israel stretches its arms over to the right. Judah dwells down into the Negev, and so is Edom. This is the wilderness. It's often translated Negev wilderness. Same thing. And this is where God brought them, to the edge of the Jordan, overlooking. Here's if we get a little bit more helpful of a picture. It's the same thing, just tilted sideways, coming through the land of Edom, and then crossing a river, Moab, up to, you have the Meribah Plateau up here. And right about this circle is where Moses looks over into the promised land, and God shows him the extent of the land from north to south. He gets either an incredibly clear day, or God has some supernatural, a miraculous way of showing him this land. But that's where it's from, and you can see far, even on a clear day. Perhaps on a clearer day, one could see even further and the extent of the land. Goes through Edom, Moab, Ammon, the Golan Heights, and up to Bashan. And there God brought Moses to the end of his journey. He was not to cross over because of his disobedience, his unbelief, his complaint that he had given into the people. He was not to go into the land. And so there, on the plains of Moab, he preaches his final sermon, or sermons. If ever you think that a sermon has gone long, just read through the book of Deuteronomy. This was Moses to the people. Fantastic sermons that reiterate this travel from exiting Sinai into the wilderness, across the wilderness. Those first few chapters are all just the history of how God brought them from nation to nation, through, and to the brink of where they then stood. Ready, come the doorstep of Joshua, to now enter into the land that had been given them, into the other side of the Jordan. And so Moses could see how God's story had and would continue to unfold. Looking out across the Jordan River Valley, here you can see the Jordan River, this dark line that runs through the land here. Here's the plains of Moab here, lush land. But this little line that goes through and all the way up to the north is that Jordan River that he looks across. It's not a very pretty sight. Looking into the land that you're going up to, it actually seems very barren. And one would wonder, is this really the land that God has promised? The land flowing with milk and honey that he's promised to bring us into? But as it turns out, they were standing, this is now looking up the Jordan River Valley, they were looking up from Mount Nebo, from the eastern hills, across to the other side of the Jordan. There's a Jordan River that actually sits below the Mediterranean Sea. And the way that the rain falls, that whole side of the wilderness area, the Judean wilderness, it falls into a rain shadow. And so it has very, very little rain at all. Almost zero vegetation. Just these whitish tan hills that go up into the toward the peak. And then they get rain more on the other side, it washes down. But this is where God had led them. Moses looks into the promised land, and he sees from Nebo toward a few of the ways that even the patriarchs before him had come. Here's that highway that they followed through the land. Came down further onto Egypt. They had their altar at Hebron, at Beersheba, and up at Shechem. This was the first place that Abram had made an altar to God to worship him for his provision. And that can be seen from the distance. That Shechem, where we saw just a second ago, we zoomed in and considered this valley. This is now looking down that valley. This would have been the very spot that the patriarchs walked. Even the city of Shechem, the Tel today, it still has a gate. It's dated back to the time of Abram, that was around even when Abram made his journey through these neck of the woods. This was the same place that the law that Moses had given to them was read once they crossed the Jordan River. They were to read the blessings from Mount Gerizim and the curses from Mount Ebal. And the way that the mountains are oriented, again, just with the hemispheres that they lie on and the way the sun falls and the rain falls, from the vantage of Shechem, down below, it looks as though Mount Gerizim is this lush and green hill, the blessings read from Mount Gerizim. And from Shechem, looking up to Mount Ebal, it looks like an absolutely barren wasteland, a hill that has nothing on it. Even these visual signs, the blessings read from Gerizim, the curses read from Ebal. This was the place where God would continue to show himself and to provide for these people. And these are the highways. If you continue along this highway, you then disappear up right around here to make your way up into the Judean hills, up toward Jerusalem. That's the route that the patriarchs followed. Abram, Isaac, Jacob went back and forth along this route up to Israel. And even later down the road, others would use this road. Jesus himself would likely take would take the same route through Mount Gerizim, which is the Samaritans up here. So we zoom back then to Mount Nebo. Also, what would have been seen from that vantage right in the foreground is Jericho. That dark patch that you get just beyond the river is some of the settlements of Jericho even today that heads up into the hills. Here's now on the other side of the river, looking back across to Mount Nebo, which is this area just there on the right, and the Jericho Hills, going into the Judean wilderness, those dead white hills that we saw on the previous image. From Jericho, from where the arrow's pointing to the Tell, the old city of Jericho, you can look up into the hills, and that's the image that you get. That was the area that they were going to go in, defeat, burn all that was there so that it could not be settled. I wonder if a part of that was so that they didn't look back. They weren't, as it were, even able to look back to the past, back to their lives of slavery. The complaint had come, God, you've taken us out of this land of Egypt, where we had all of these provisions. We had leeks and onions. We had a menu that seemed to abound. And you brought us into this desolate land. They were commanded here to burn Jericho completely and move on into the foothills of Judea. I wonder if that was a part of the reason. And yet, whatever way, these are the hills that we get around us today. There's a monastery that goes around those hills there, where Jesus is remembered to have been tempted. Really, we don't know where he was tempted in the wilderness on a height. But that's where they remember it, and they have a monastery up there. But if you look across the valley, you actually see, even still today, this picture, I don't know if you can tell, right here, you squint your eyes and look real closely, you can see, actually even there, it's kind of difficult to see. Right there, you get two boys, and some goats, and some sheep. This is the pasture land of a Judean wilderness shepherd. Who was a shepherd in the wilderness of Judea? David. It's not exactly the green pastures that you think of. This is in the luscious month of the year, right around March. These are the green pastures, the green hills that we read of even in Psalm 23. And would you know it, the most common cause of death in the Judean wilderness Would you take a guess as far as what it might be?
Falling.
Not falling per se, though it can include it, but it's actually drowning. Drowning is the most common cause of death in the wilderness. Now, it may well include falling down, because what happens, especially for the sheep, is they go down to the water, there's a stream that's coming down the valley, and they get stuck, their wool gets all soaked up with wool, and down they go. The goats at least have a little more sense, and they don't have quite as much fluff, so they can get out more quickly, but the dumb old sheep just go right on down. And you get these flash floods that come through the wilderness. This is, I think, some of the imagery that you get in Jesus' parable. The man that built his house on the sand. Now, this is fine for a foundation 10, 11 months of the year. But come the flash flood, when the rains come, make their way down and pour through the land, that house is gone. And so God compares, Jesus compares the man who hears these words and does not listen. It's like someone who goes and builds his house on the sand. And when the rains came and the flood swept by, great was his destruction. So again, a picture just online of one of the flood seasons around that same wilderness. This is one valley over from Jericho. And so we get these foothills, we get the sheep and the goats grazing among them. These are the green pastures, the rainy season, where the shepherd tends his flock. It's not exactly what we think of when we read of them, but there was food enough for the sheep, for the shepherd, to eat whatever wriggles, to get the nutrients, and there was food enough to sustain. He shepherded them. And you do find, even in the same wilderness, there's a couple places where the canyons are deeper, and there's one in particular, a canyon that has a beautiful waterfall with some greener vegetation around it. En Gedi is the name of that spot. But this is looking from Bethlehem now, just outside Bethlehem, toward the Dead Sea. You could see Mount Nebo just here, just beyond this picture here, up on the plains there of Moab above them. And you've got the Dead Sea out in the distance. This is the view from Bethlehem, where David grew up. And that brings us then from Moses, really, his view across the valley to consider the life of David, the shepherd. He was born in Bethlehem. That's right down here, this little red dot. Here again, you can see the view just a picture ago. It was across the Dead Sea. There's where Moses would have looked up from Mount Nebo. Here's looking across the sea. And the Dead Sea just off in the distance. This was his backyard. That wilderness, that dry, seemingly barren land at a glance. Born in Bethlehem, the youngest of his brothers, and his great-grandmother was from Moab. Now, if you recall from just at the beginning, when we recall the land that the Israelites passed through, they actually went around these routes, they weren't allowed to come through by those inhabiting, but Moab was one of these nations. Now, this was one of the lands they were told not to marry, not to intermix, because they were not a God-fearing people. They must remain holy and separate from them. And yet, come the time of famine in Bethlehem, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, takes the family, both his wife and his two sons, over to the land of Moab to sojourn. That's David's great-grandma. They sojourn there. Both the sons find a wife. Both the sons die. And Ruth and Orpah are now left with a choice. Do they go with Naomi? Do they stay where they can find someone else? Of their own family, their own clan back in Moab. And Ruth, in those famous words, she chooses to stick with Naomi. For your people are my people and your God is my God. Naomi, I've seen the testimony of what you have lived in these 10 years you've been in Moab. I want to follow your God. I'm not going back to my house and my gods. And she sits with, the story of Ruth. So there's then from Bethlehem, the same view that we have of David, his backyard, out toward Moab, across the Dead Sea. That was his family's home. Quite a close sight. Now on a clearer day, though Moab would be a little bit to the right of this picture, if you look across the Dead Sea, there you've got it. Land of long ago. And so when we see David growing up, when he's a young boy, Saul is king, the first king over Israel. and he sets up his capital at Gibeah. This was a little ways up the road from Bethlehem, that red dot. And his capital was right on a crossroads between these big highways. So though they were tucked away in the hills, it was right on one of those paths that connect the east and the west, especially along this western part of the land. And Saul's kingdom, he stretched quite a considerable amount, not as far as David's kingdom, but he reached out across into those trade routes to set up his kingdom. When Saul, and actually as Saul was on the throne, that's where we find all of this talk about the Philistines. The Philistines are here on the coastlands. They have their five capital cities here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Two of them inland and three of them here along the coast. We've got these five capital cities. This is the Philistines' stomping grounds. That's where they like to hang out. Here is Judah's stomping grounds. That's where they hang out. Here is contested land that over the course of Samuel we see going back and forth and back and forth. The Philistines come up into the highlands. Then the Israelites go down into the valleys. You notice all these images until they get to the story of David and Goliath. That's here when the Philistines were pushing up into the hills and to try and combat that and come against it so that they couldn't come up to Judea, up to their own capital, their own land. They make a stand here in the Elah Valley, right here. That was there in the term is the Shephelah, but really it's whether it's translated the foothills or sometimes the lowlands. But those are sort of the foothills, just the low curving hills that go up to the hills of Judea. And so they make that stand, David and Goliath looking out. I don't have a picture of the field unfortunately here, but we see those battles raging to and from. And finally, even at the end of Saul's life, he makes a stand up here at Mount Gilboa, which is right here. Notice what a crucial place that is. There's people passing through from east to west, one of the biggest east-west corridors, and there's people passing through north-south. Now this is where the cats come through from both directions. North-south, east-west. The Jezreel Valley is a crucial area. We'll look more at that in just a bit. But you've got all of these places that converge right around here with a load of travel that takes place. Even when Rome comes, they stretch into this. Their ships come here, stretch into the Decapolis across the way so that they have control of both these trade routes. Even in Saul's time, he makes his final stand at Mount Gilboa. We know the story, not he or Jonathan make it out alive. Meanwhile, David is down here. He's trying not to fight in that battle because he's actually taken sides as a spy, in a sense, of the Philistines. The Philistines hire David and they say, great, you should go down to these lowlands in the Negev and in the wilderness and you go take care of all these little riots that are popping up, all the unsettlements. You go and take care of that for us so that we don't have any disturbances down there. Thanks, David. And he says, great. He builds their trust and he goes down. Meanwhile, he destroys the enemy of Judah, which are semi-allies of the Philistines. He takes them out and brings back report. There's no problems. And so he doesn't want to go up to battle with the Philistines because he knows he would be going against both Saul and Jonathan. So he tries to make it seem, oh no, really, I really would love to go up to you, go up with you to battle. But they said, well no, really, you should probably stay down here, hey, and take care of things. And he said, well, man, but I do wish to go up. And they said, no, you stay here. Oh, okay, all right. And he stays down here in with the closer to the Philistines territory here. Meanwhile, he's doing his grabs and looting and all that down in the Negev. Quite a character, and he gets to know the land. I think he's been hiding, even when Saul was alive, here in the desert, in the hills, in the wilderness from Saul. Several times Saul tried to kill him. Twice David had Saul's life in his hands, and he spares him, because that was God's anointed, and I will not touch God's anointed. Spares his life, escapes, and continues on. hired as a musician for the king, goes to defeat an army here of Goliath and the Philistines coming up the western side, gets to know all of the lower land, the desert and wilderness down here. He really has a good grasp of the land by the time he becomes king. And so David, when he becomes king, moves the capital from the blue dot there, a little further down to the border of the two of the tribes, to set up his kingdom in Jerusalem. He has his captain take out the Jebusites, and they set up their kingdom at Jerusalem. Just briefly, as far as the importance of that, Jerusalem, which you can see right here, at the bottom of Bethlehem, at the bottom of the tribe of Benjamin, and at the north of Judah, it was in between the tribes. It wasn't associated with the tribe of Benjamin or the tribe of Judah. He had previously been settled down in Hebron, but he moved his capital up to Jerusalem, which was essential ground. It was in between. It was nonpartisan. It was like in between the territories, almost like in the states. We have Washington, D.C. It's not in the one state or the other. It's its own district, so that it is not, as the capital of the U.S., it is not belonging to one or other state. That was David's move. He longed to unite the kingdom under his reign. And we see that. We see it coming together even of the kingdom, and under Solomon, his son, as well. His kingdom expands as he sets his capital up, his kingdom, in Jerusalem. Here's Jerusalem then. We see the city of David. All that David had as his capital was this little area here. And up on the top was where the temple was to be built, which hadn't yet been constructed because David was a man of war. It couldn't be built by someone who had blood on his hands. It would have to be built by Solomon. So Solomon, as his son, built that temple later on. Let me just draw your attention, though, to the geography. Well, I'll draw that actually in just a sec. God establishes his covenant with David, and he says that he would make him a throne, a kingdom that endures forever. Of your line, your kingdom, there will be no end, and of your offspring. And so we get this picture: as the mountains surround Jerusalem, so God surrounds his people. Psalm 125, verse 2. That could only be written from here. If that was written later on, it wouldn't have made sense. Because the city of David is not the highest part of the city. The temple is the highest part of Jerusalem. And from the temple, if you look out around, the mountains don't surround Jerusalem. But if you go down to the city of David and look around, you are engulfed in the surrounding mountains. So even there, the Psalm of David, as the mountains surround Jerusalem, written by David, so God surrounds his people. You can see that the hills around, there's two big valleys that come. You'll find that if you, as you're reading, you find the kingdoms that are spoken of, it always knows that danger comes from the north. Danger comes from the north. That is because, as you look really at Jerusalem, there's these steep hills that surround it. You have a valley on the right side, you have a valley continuing around the west side, and if you were to try and take an army up that hill, you would come against, let me just get that down here to the bottom, you would come against this steep uprising, you can see there on the one side, to bring an army up those steep cliffs. Meanwhile, you could throw whatever you wanted down on these soldiers trying to make their way up. You have a very, very high advantage. And so, when danger comes, when the enemy comes, it always comes from the north. Because as they get to Jerusalem, they come up even from the south, they have to go around so that they can bring all of their weaponry, all of their soldiers easily to that point. So it makes sense that as Solomon establishes his city, the temple, he actually builds that on the highest part, the more defensible part, more secure spot that the temple was to rest. You compare that then with Jesus' own day. Someone who came in the line of David, who sat on the throne of David, in that kingdom that would never see an end. This was the city of Jesus' day, expanded further up, We see there, even as justice was done in the gates when Jesus was tried, the justice would likely have been done right about here in the gates, led out of the city to Golgotha, the place of the skull, where within the city today, the walls have changed over history. Within the city walls today, you would find that there's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the Church of the Resurrection that sits about there. Where exactly along this old catacomb system he was buried, he was crucified and buried, we don't know. But we know that he was crucified outside the city of that day. This wall would not have been there. This is a one that was only built later on, in Josephus' time. But there would have been outside the city where he was crucified. That's the Jerusalem then of Jesus' day, of the New Testament period. So we get those valleys that we see coming up around it, the valleys that surrounded it. Here's the Mount of Olives, off to the right. This is the picture Jesus gives when he talks about whitewashed tombs. Woe to you, Pharisees, blind guides. You are as whitewashed tombs. Where are the Pharisees that he's talking to there in Matthew? In Jerusalem. What's one of the most visible eye shots of that city? Just across the valley, the Kidron Valley, you've got all of these graves stretched up the hill. Even today, there's still people that's quite a prime spot to be buried, because they believe that the Messiah walks into Jerusalem, and those Jews that don't believe that he has come, as the Messiah walks into Jerusalem, we will see the dead raised from. So they have front row seats right there. Whitewashed tombs, though. That was the woe that he had declared. And you build yourself monuments right here. You get these monuments, big monuments of tombs. And the edifice is the face of these tombs. Even Absalom's pillar, where he built a monument for himself, that's there in the Kidron Valley as you come down. Here's the pool of Siloam. That was where we have the man who was to, the blind man who was to walk all the way down to the pool of Siloam, washed from the temple steps, that's here. This is dirt that has since been added over the build-up from the time since Jesus. A couple thousand years of the habit of building up some, but you have going from the Pool of Siloam up this route and over to the temple steps. So here's the Temple Mount of today. Just out of interest, this is now where the temple had sat, and during the Islamic conquest they had replaced the temple, or the temple was destroyed during the Islamic conquest. They had put a mosque there to commemorate. They also commemorate where Abram sacrificed his son, different son. But there's that little booth outside, and that's where they have a little space to commemorate it. But this holy space that they claim as a mosque, and this one, Al-Aqsa Mosque, off to the other side of the Temple Mount, is where they claim that Muhammad rose back to heaven. So that's now the landscape today. Obviously, very different sort of look, a few more buildings than before, and Mount of Olives, Mount Scopus here. This is where Jesus came in, into Bethlehem, riding on a donkey over. Mary and Martha were about here on this book, and they came from the book over the hill and made their way into the city. This is where he was then to come with palm branches, celebrated even now every year. They come with palm branches and they make a procession into the city, down the hill, Mount of Olives, over the bridge and into the city. Actually, sorry, right about here, they come into the city and they commemorate his entry. A few days after which, those very same crowds that had heard of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, that were cheering him on with palms, now hail, shouted, "Crucify him." The mob swung in the flip of a hat. There then, I'll just be repeating myself, I guess, you get the idea, the valley, the Hinnom Valley, I didn't mention that, that's the other valley that comes around the left, the west and southern side of the city. That was where you have kings like Manasseh offering up children to their gods and throwing them off into the valley of Gehenna, the Hinnom Valley, as we know it today. It's just the toponym of the same place. That was a valley off of the sides of the city of Jerusalem. These children were sacrificed to their gods. And as you look then out to the distance, You see now we're looking at it the other way around. Here's the Kidron Valley. There's the south side of the city. You can see this is now backwards. There's the Dome of the Sepulchre. There's the, I'm sorry, not the Sepulchre. This is the Dome of the Mount and Al-Aqsa Mosque looking out toward. You see this right on the edge of Jerusalem. It sits just overlooking that Judean wilderness. That's David's backyard. And just up here in the distance is Bethlehem, in eyeshot of Jerusalem. You can see where Jesus was born and where he died. In one shot, in one vantage. That was his life. He came, the Lion of David. He died as the Lamb of God for the sins of the people. Very close proximity, right there on the foothills of Judea. So with that, let's leave Jerusalem, leave Bethlehem, and work our way back along to Nazareth as Jesus, as a boy, would have done, returning from the feast of the Passover with his family. We read about one specific account in Luke 12. We really don't get much at all of Jesus' childhood, but in Luke 2, we get the story of Jesus coming back from the feast of Passover. From Luke 2:41. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover, and when he was 12 years old, they went up, according to the custom. When the feast ended, and they were returning, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem, and his parents didn't know about it. So here's Nazareth, up on this ridge. This is pretty close to where Saul and Jonathan met their end, in this Jezreel Valley, one of the most significant crossroads, east and west, through this land. Nazareth is just here up on that little ridge overlooking it. They've made their way down 4 days, plus minus, journey, depending on your pace and how much of the day you travel, down to Jerusalem. That's their journey, following the same path around Shechem that we looked at earlier, the place where Abram made an offering, made an altar to God. Coming up then into the hills, we said that the hills disappear and work their way up to the height, follows the ridge all the way down to Jerusalem. So they made their way from Nazareth to Jerusalem. His parents start that 4 day back, and to their surprise, no Jesus. But supposing him to be in the group, they went a day's journey. But then they began to search for him among their relatives. Yeah, he might not be here, and acquaintances. And when they didn't find him, they returned to Jerusalem searching for him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them, asking questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. And when his parents saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us so? Behold, your father and I have been searching for you in great distress." It's a funny image that's put up. The leaders there, the Pharisees and the scribes, are sitting there astonished that he is asking the questions he is. And Mary and Joseph come in, and Mary finds him, and she is astonished. How could you leave us? A little bit of a different picture that we get. But they go then, they make their way back. Jesus says, "I must be about my father's business." And yet, in verse 50, they did not understand the saying he spoke to them. They went down with them and came to Nazareth. Quick note, how did they go down from here to here? It's going up, isn't it? If you're up on the hills, that would make sense, though. You are going down to Nazareth. So that's why whenever you go to Jerusalem, you go up. How does David begin his song? "I was glad when they said, let us go up to Jerusalem, up to the house of the Lord." All of the images to Jerusalem are going up. Everything from Jerusalem goes down. It's on the ridge. So that's helpful if you're thinking, you're looking at a map and saying, "Hang on, some translator got this backward. That's up, that's down." Go up to Jerusalem and down to Nazareth. And yet it says, when he went down to Jerusalem, even as the Son of God, the Savior of the world, he honors his parents. It says he came to Nazareth and was submissive to them. And his mother treasured up all these things in her heart. God of the universe honoring, submitting to the parents that have been put over him. That's incredibly humbling to consider. And so then as we get back up to Nazareth, we visit, we come to find then one of the lost perches of the evening, and that's this Nazareth Ridge. You can see here Nazareth tucked away, if you just look at a different sort of map, same routes as we've been talking about, the one going up north-south, and the one going east-west through this flat land. There's hills all around this area, but this flat land, this wide plain that passes through. And so here on the outskirts of that, right on the ridge, is Nazareth. This area is Nazareth. And so we get then the story of Jesus. His boyhood, he grows up here in Nazareth. So he's born in Bethlehem. He was of the house of David. He was called a Nazarene. Both of those prophecies are true. He grows up here in Nazareth. Nazareth, the spot that was geographically completely cut off from the rest of Israel and Judah. You had Samaria, Ephraim, Judah here to the south. And you had Galilee sort of stuck on its own up to the north with this big valley passing through. And all the soldiers and foot traffic and trade would be going through these corridors non-stop, busily going about their way. And they're sort of cut off from the rest of Israel, the rest of Judah. So whenever they go out, they have to come across this big line of traffic and go onto the hills now below them. There's this spatial divide. Let's look at that here from Nazareth. This is the view that one would see. You see out toward the sea, that's Mount Carmel. So this is now looking back south. There's the rest of Israel, the rest of Judea down below. You see Mount Carmel would be not this close ridge, but in the distance, just there on the, that's the foothills of Mount Carmel, but really the peak of which would be right about here. So you've got Carmel there. And this is where Elijah met with the prophets of Baal, up on the top of Mount Carmel. And you can see the other side is over to the ocean, that you've got the coast on the one side, and the mountain here that he goes up, and he makes his altar. They fill it with water after nothing has happened to the prophets of Baal's sacrifice. And sure enough, God sends down fire on the mountain and consumes the offering and all the water. And all the prophets of Baal, they scatter and run about. But Elijah is quite a strong guy, obviously did his PT, and he catches up with them and takes all of them out. That's Mount Carmel. That's the story in eyeshot, though in the distance, eyeshot of the Nazareth Ridge. And from there, if you now look back toward, from Mount Carmel, back toward the valley, there's a lot of things that you can see from that vantage. You get Megiddo, we'll come to that later. Dothan is from the story of Joseph and his brothers. They're down in Hebron, which is much further off this picture, down in Hebron. And his brothers have taken the sheep up for grazing pasture. So they go up to the more lush Dothan, up here closer to the Jezreel Valley, where there's more rainfall, more grass that they can graze. They make their way up. And David sent out to that, I'm sorry, not David, Joseph is sent up to come see how his brothers are doing. That's there in Dothan. The Ishmaelite slave traders pass through. They're going on their way down to Egypt. And they find him, take him, sold into captivity, and Joseph is taken down to Egypt. Shechem, then off in the distance, just for a reference sake from earlier, that's where it is behind. You can see Jerusalem is here along this ridge further on. So that's looking now the other direction. And this is Mount Carmel here in the foreground that you look down toward. One of those prominent spots in the Jezreel Valley is this place, Megiddo. You can see all of the other main ports of entry through this valley from Megiddo. Just to show you the size of it, this is one of the grain silos. That's not just a couple families that made their afternoons down to Megiddo for an afternoon nap or a snack. There was a serious port, a serious passing through here at Megiddo. This is where they stored the grain, and there's all sorts of archaeological digs that have opened up, just a massive structure here at Megiddo. This is one of the prime watch posts of the Jezreel Valley. Looking across here, this is Mount Gilboa, where Saul and Jonathan met their end. Mount Moray, off in the distance, and Nazareth is just up off to this end. Right? So now we're looking from the south end toward, just as another
another way of looking, that's Megiddo. You come from the port at Acre, one of the main natural port of the western coast there on the Mediterranean. Come through the passes, Mount Carmel there on the west, looking down toward Megiddo. That's the center of the crossroads. There's a couple other routes you could take through the hills, but that's smack in the center, very, very heavily trafficked route. And you've got your trade going east to west through the Rhone Valley and on to the east. So that's a big spot here, just from the last picture. This is Dothan, and you've got Shechem down here, all within that line, that sort of line of sight from Mount Carmel towards Megiddo, and so on. You get the picture. This is where Jesus grows up, looking out toward Mount Carmel, toward Megiddo, toward Dothan there in the back, Mount Gilboa, Mount Moriah, and there's not Jesus, but Caleb. And then you go through this out to the Sea of Galilee, and finally here on the west side, Mount Tabor. You go back here though, this is where, just to kind of picture the story, the witch at Endor. Endor is right here. What's that? Is it Endor? Yes, that's right. In the book of Samuel, but Saul, who comes to the witch at Endor. Yeah, sorry if I said the wrong name. The Philistines are camped here, on the one side of Mount Moriah. Mount Gilboa, you have the Israelite camp on this little hill. You can see that it disappears there. Not the far horizon, but this mountain ridge here. They're camped here. Saul goes around the mountain, comes to Endor here, and consults the witch. Not a good thing. Got Samuel that he calls up, and he finds out, okay, this is actually not good news. You're not going to win the battle. You've come to an end. That was right around here. You've got that story. You've got there Joseph coming to his brothers in Dothan. But all these stories of Jesus growing up, these stories of times past, of God's faithfulness, now are at his fingertips, or is within his eyeshot growing up. Right along the Jezreel Valley from Nazareth and Mount Tabor up to the Sea of Galilee. That was in the story of Barak and Deborah and Sisera coming through. Right, we get that story. If you were to sort of pan out then, it's not a very detailed picture, but if you were to pan out, there's the map that we saw just now with the Jezreel Valley passing through. And this is the spectrum you get, all the way from Mount Carmel here on the right, Megiddo, Mount Tabor. This was the playing field of a story that we get in Judges 4. The story of Deborah and Barak. But just to sort of see how that pans out then over these routes. This is an important route to gain control of. So the king of the Canaanites, who was in Hazor, the same one, which is a little bit further off to the north, around the Sea of Galilee. That's where he's ruling from. He sends Sisera with his 900 chariots into this flat land. Now for chariots, this is ideal territory. They've got a flat surface. They can't take their chariots up into the hills of Judea. We scarcely would read that someone had a chariot in the hills of Jerusalem. It would be incredibly impractical. But when we find chariots, it's in Egypt, in the long flat plains that you've got there in Egypt. We get it up to the northwest in Bashan, Og and his chariots. Big old man, everything sort of larger than life, these volcanic flatlands. You get the chariots further down to the south, further up to the east, in the big ports of this region. You also get, if we look at this map, Hazor is right around here, coming down through the valley. He now has control of this trade route with his chariots. 900 chariots he brings down the valley and across. And he stations them right here at Megiddo. And you can recall then where Deborah and Barak were stationed? Hot quiz. They were in Mount Tabor. They're all on this little hill up on the top. And they have 900 chariots coming their way. That's not exactly good news for everyone here. There's more people, 10,000, but they're all on foot. And those horses and their chariots can come in with full fury. not to mention the other foot soldiers that they had with them. That's not good news. So what happens? How does God win the victory for them? We really only get the details. We find it's a most disappointing narrative when we read it through, because all it says is that they defeated Sisera and his army. And you think, wait a second, what did you leave out? How on earth, there's a chapter missing. How did they defeat 900 chariots out on an open plain, where chariots have by far the upper hand? Well, come Judges 5, when the song of Deborah and Barak is sung. This is what is sung: that the leaders took the lead in Israel, that the people offered themselves willingly. Bless the Lord. Hear, O kings, give ear, O princes, to the Lord I will sing. I'll make melody to the Lord, the God of Israel. This playing field, almost a theater that Sisera could have had his heart's content to wipe out these little Israelites on foot, has now become the playing field, the theater of God's work. I will bless the Lord, not Sisera, not the captain of the Canaanite army. Verse 4 of the song: Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the region of Edom, the earth trembled and the heavens dropped. Yes, the clouds dropped water. There you have it. How helpful is chariot when this is flooded with water? Not very helpful. Stuck in the mud, in fact. That's the Jezreel Valley. And even today in the plain season, the river Kishon, which they talk about in that song of Deborah and Barak, is not nearly as wide in its banks because it's been irrigated out to the rest of the Jezreel Valley. That valley in rainy season is flat. And it floods, it becomes these almost marshlands. It's much harder to travel. This road is up on a little bit of an elevated area so as to stay out of the more volatile areas for getting that water. There's a few routes through it. You see even here, this is the route that was made from Megiddo up to Mount Tabor, and all of their soldiers on foot came down to meet Sisera and his very stuck-in-the-mud chariots and wiped them out because God flooded this Jezreel Valley. They couldn't move. The Kishon River, which flowed through it, empties here at the Herod Springs. All of these locations then are brought up within that song. And so we see God working in victory for his people there. Then if you go just up to the north, you have the south, you get that gap, and it's just about a cliff face. This is where Jesus, when he comes back to begin his ministry, preaches in the synagogue. If you go to Luke 5, just after that account of Jesus returning from Nazareth, a few paragraphs down the story, in Luke 4, 16, Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit to Galilee, and a report went about him through all the surrounding country, and he taught in their synagogues, being glorified by all. And he came to Nazareth, where he'd been brought up. And as was his custom, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day. He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." He rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. Why does the suspense build here in the story? It seems it moves very slowly at this point. He rolls the scroll up, he gives it back, he sits down, and even the next sentence is, "And the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on it." I mean, this is like in a film, you just sort of get this slow motion, the scroll goes back, it's rolled up, he takes his seat, everyone's glued on him. What is he going to say? This was the build-up for the interpretation or the application now of this passage. was quite a common practice. You have the schedule of readings from the scrolls, and then it was given over to a person that was oftentimes scheduled a month or two in advance to read from that portion and share something of an application, almost a very brief little sermon. So here's now, what is he going to say about this passage? And everyone's eyes are fixed on him. And he says, today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. Wow. God has done it. It's fulfilled. And they marvel. That was all he said. And they marvel. This passage from Isaiah, was fulfilled in their hearing. And all spoke well of him, it says, and marveled at the gracious words that were coming from his mouth. He had brought good news. Those who are in captivity, those who are in bondage, those who are blind will be given sight. Those who are in captivity will be set free. The bonds of our oppression will be loose. Why was that significant in Nazareth? Tucked away in this place where later on, actually before that time, one of his own disciples would say, can anything good come from Nazareth? Are you kidding me? The Messiah? Not a chance. He is from Nazareth. There's nothing good that comes from it. There's sort of stuff off up in the north, up in Galilee. Galilee was even known for some of its stranger teachings that had different interpretations, I'll think, than down in Jerusalem, the more orthodox part of understanding, or Judaism. And they had some strange stuff going on, and it was this nothing area. And this was right at the edge of this little nobody town. How on earth could the Messiah of the world come from there? Because armies now in Jesus' day were passing through. It wasn't the Greeks any longer. It was now the Romans going to and from, setting up their establishments here on the east side, going back across to trade on the Mediterranean, passing through north and south for their marching through the land. This whole valley was overrun with Rome. And there were these little corridors of God's people living faithfully in the land, and all of their enemies, all of their oppressors were just trampling across their land, right at their doorstep, here in the valley. But now, Jesus says, this has been fulfilled. You are set free. I have proclaimed that you will be free, and that the captives will be set free, will be released from those bonds. But Jesus goes on to say, look, it's not what you are saying. The reason that you're rejoicing, that is to just take away the Roman oppression, that's not what I've come to do. They say to him, is this not Joseph's son? Doubts begin to emerge in their mind as far as, how on earth could this be true? I mean, that's quite a statement, but could this really be true? John's gospel fleshes that out a little bit fully. But he responds to them and says, doubtless you will quote to me the proverb, physician, heal yourself. What we've heard you did at Capernaum, that's down by the lake over here, what we've heard you do in Capernaum, do here as well, in your hometown. There was a doubting to what he was saying, a mockery at what he had mentioned. And he said, truly I say to you, no prophet is acceptable in his own time. But in truth I tell you that there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the heavens were shut up 3 years and 6 months, and a great famine came over the land. And Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath. Elijah at Carmel, the heavens shut up for that long duration, Ahab over here in Jezreel. And the heavens are shut up, and who does he minister? He ministers to someone who is up in Zarephath, up here along the Phoenician coast. Those were the enemies. Those were the outsiders, the Gentiles, those that were put off, that were cast away. Those weren't the Jews, those weren't Israel, those weren't the people of God. But what does Jesus say? Who did Elijah minister to? He didn't just throw off his oppressors. He didn't just throw off the surrounding armies. No. He ministered to your enemies. Those who are around the outskirts here of Galilee. And he goes on. And were there many lepers in Israel at the time of the prophet Elisha? And none of them were cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian, further up to the north. Syria passed through these borders, and you have Sidon, where that widow is from, Syria here. He's saying, look, there were many, many lepers in Israel, but who did Elisha heal? No, it was someone of your enemies. One of these people that are traipsing through. I didn't come simply to throw off Rome from you, no. I came to set up my kingdom. And they are furious. Jesus, what on earth? This has gone from bad to worse. You haven't simply just given in to this mockery and gone your way. You've actually put more of a stoke in the fire, taunting and pushing even more. Consider the help and ministry to Sidon. Consider the ministry to Syria. That was what the prophets did. And so he comes there to be questioned by this people. And they wanted to throw him off the cliff. So one of the steeper areas, just actually to the right of this, you get some of these steep edges of Nazareth. They bring him to the edge of the cliff and are about to throw him off. So that they could throw him off the cliff. And again, one of these other chapters that are just completely missing from the text. But, passing through their midst, he went away. It's not fair. That was Jesus' backyard. But let me wrap up briefly. I do just want to show you a view just further north then, along the same trade route. Here you have the Jezreel Valley. This is big, lush farmland. Even today, a massive amount of farming that comes. But up here, the Beth and Tofa Valley, one of the smaller valleys and yet equally as lush, was the breadbasket of Israel. Looking down toward the Natopa Valley, there's Nazareth that's now off to the right in this picture, sort of a halfway mark. Cana, that's right here, this is where the wedding is, so we would walk these routes, these paths, across these fields. You can still see even today these fields that they continue to plumb. That's the land that Jesus walks through. He walks to Cana, to the wedding, and he goes by this sort of imagery. This is where he gets this parable imagery. It's not anything foreign. It was daily, usual, commonly understood images. A sower went to sow some seed, and some fell on the rocky ground. Some fell on the path. Some fell in the thorns and thistles, and some fell on good ground. In a single square meter, that's all there. The path, the rocky ground, the thorns demarcating the edge of fields. They still use sometimes rocks, sometimes thorns, thistles that grow off the edge, and the field off to the side. The boundaries of the fields. You have down at the, if you look into the fields, there's both wheat and tares that are growing up together. They look pretty similar. Should we chuck out the tares and keep the wheat? No, let them grow up together. Wheat and tares. In the time of harvesting, we will cut them all down and separate the wheat and the tares. The wheat will be kept, but the tares will be thrown into the fire. And so you have this imagery even of the sower. The ground where the birds come, it's trodden underfoot, they eat it up. The rocky ground where the word of God takes hearing, it quickly shoots up, but then it dies, it has no moisture. We're like the thorns, the thistles that surround, and they're choked out by the cares and the pleasures of this world. Or finally on the good ground. This is one who hears my word and does it, says Jesus. He who has an ear to hear, let him hear. So Jesus moves from Nazareth, up and down from Jerusalem to the feast, the various feasts that they had each year, to the temple down in Jerusalem. He goes to the wedding up here in Cana on the Natopa Valley. And in turn, he makes his way out to Capernaum. Strategic route for a witness that he would make, not simply to Galilee, not simply to that region, but to the world. That message would be seen, heard, known by all manner of people passing through these corridors. 80% of the Gospels, 80% of Jesus' ministry happened in this little triangle. Capernaum, Chorazin, Bethsaida. That's it. That's his ministry. And yet it's right along this international highway. Small little spot, but he goes out and he doesn't claim for prowess, for expanding his kingdom across the land. No, he looks to spread his kingdom to all who would hear, all who would believe, and to trust in what he said, to receive him as Lord. From this little dot there on the edge of the highway, just a view toward. We won't go into any details, sorry, it was a panorama, I cut his arm twice. But there's the triangle again. Chorazin up to the coast, I'm sorry, yeah, Capernaum, Chorazin, and Bethsaida. That evangelical triangle. The majority of the Gospels take place in that tiny little area. The call of Peter right at the end, says right here where he makes the proclamation that you are the Son of God, and further up into Galilee. So we won't go into any of this, but just a taste to get a picture. That's the size. It's actually a relatively sized lake, but that's the lake where the disciples go out, they fish. And I must just also throw this in for good measure because this guy's from Joburg. There's John. And next to an old Israeli fisherman, they still to this day pull up their nets and do their mending. You can see all the lines where they've mended nets together, they've sewn in holes. After everything, there's holes that the fish have made through, there's tears that come up, and they take the time, they roll them up and they sort out all the tears, fixing their nets, mending their nets. That was when Jesus came to his disciples. And he called them, follow me. So then as we just zoom back, we see Jesus entering. Sort of where have we come? I know it's a taste of a fair amount of the land. We've sort of seen some of these regions across the Jordan Valley. Seen a little bit around here of the Jezreel Valley, one of those main corridors going through the land. Consider the way that even from Jerusalem or Gilead, depending on where the capital was at the time, the way that they could reach out to these international highways. The significance of this piece of land altogether. That this was the place where everyone was passing through. And Jesus comes, God of Abraham. He is the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Before Abraham was, I am. He does come of David's royal line, born in Bethlehem, grown up in Nazareth, to die in the city that David ruled from. And he was a son of man, grew up in Nazareth, faithful and merciful. He lived as a man that he would be able in the flesh to endure all manner of temptations in every way and yet to be without sin. So he's able to help us as our high priest when we are in temptation, when we are in weakness. And finally he comes as the Lamb of God to give up his life before returning to the Father. From the ends of the world, this little spot played and plays quite a useful role. All these nations, you think of how important that passageway still is. Russia to the right, looking to get down to the Mediterranean for its access routes. The Middle Eastern playing board today, which we could put on the modern countries, the access is here. This crescent being given to Abram and his offspring, to Isaac and Ishmael. We see Isaac now settled here. We see Ishmaelites at large in some of these territories. Between this land and as far as your eye sees, between the river Euphrates. You see, this land, now God fulfilling his promise. First Peter, he writes, you are a chosen race. Now this is to the dispersed believers who've now gone out to the reaches of the globe. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession. Same language that we began with. As God brings his people, the tribe of Israel, out of slavery, you will be to me this. And the purpose, though, that Peter says, is you are this chosen race, this royal priesthood, you that trust in Christ, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, But now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. God didn't choose His nation, His people, because they were great and numerous and strong. He chose them because they were nothing and the smallest, so that in them He might show His greatness. And now as the message has gone out widely to the Gentiles, to you and me, who are grafted in, what a message we have to proclaim to the nations. And so then the exhortation, beloved, I urge you, as sojourners and exiles, not simply through this land, through our own land, this planet that we are on is not our home. I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God. They were established as a nation of priests, and so we even hold today the priesthood of all believers, that going out into the world, as they represented His image, His name, right there on that tiny area, crossing through these big regions, all the nations passing through that land between. Now we, as we go to the ends of the earth, to the people groups around us, to the people groups far from us, some of whom have not heard the gospel, but blessed on the mountains are the feet of Him who brings good news, who says to Zion, your God reigns. And so we have a message from now until God calls us home. Amen. Any questions or thoughts? The red dot is that those are campfires, and the green dots are little ones. No, they're unreached people groups, or people groups, I suppose. The yellow is unreached, the red is, unreached and, or minimally reached, I suppose, and the red is unreached, and in some cases unengaged, which means there's been no workers that are known among them preaching the gospel. So those are an array of different people groups. But this is from the Joshua Project. So, yeah.
I still didn't understand how the ship was drawn on the field. What was it like?
Yeah, so it's here we go. The sheep, for one, they can get washed away.
Yes.
So you're in some of these crevices, and you can, in the valleys. If you're taking, either you're taking sheep, or you're even not just the shepherds, but people that are hiking through, right? So you can take the valleys as a means of transport. You typically would go up to the ridges and stay on the ridge as long as you can, but there's places then to get down to the lowlands, you come into the valleys. If you pick a valley in the rainy season, it's coming down, you don't see that there's a flood behind you. These flash floods come. That's the beginning of a flash flood coming into the valley. This is what it can look like in its fullness. Pouring down. This is in the Judean wilderness. It's often just a dry wasteland, and that's the flash flood that comes. So when David says in his psalm about the Lord our shepherd, you lead me beside still waters. Whether you get one of these little eddies off to the side, that where the water swirls around and is not in the main flow, or you get just a calmer stream that you can come and bring the sheep down to water, that's the image he gets. Grazing green pastures, and leading beside still waters. You don't bring me out here to the deep valleys where you get swept away. But though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For you, my God, my rod and my staff are with me. That's the image, the image of the shepherd that comes up.
So see, that happens very often, or it's like a season, like a rainy season.
It does happen in the rainy season, yeah. So as the rains come, they flood, and they come quickly. Yeah. Any other thoughts or questions? Yeah, Andrew?
The land, wasn't it more green and had more, like, palm trees and things before the Romans came in 1870?
Yeah, it may well, it did look different. And even now today, if you look at the map between Israel, present-day Israel, and the West Bank, as it's sort of been delineated, you can actually see where money has been pumped in by a lot of the Western governments, by Canada, US, Europe, and they've worked to reforest some of the lands, especially on that western side. It does look far more lush, far more green. But that's still on the rain shelter that you get is on this side of the hills. That side, you can, it is much drier. I think it's less than 4 inches a year. It's very, very, very little rainfall that you get over the desert area. When you get rain coming washing through, it comes, in quite a force, but you get it tends to run off. The watershed has this much more wetter climate on the west side of the hill. So looking across the Jordan from higher, wetter, across the Jordan, Transjordan as it's called, towards Israel, it looks far more barren, far more of just a desert land and, wasteland. But as you get up into the hills and look over, it's much more lush. In the Shpela, where you got, I think there was just one picture, like Elijah at Carmel, and you get the picture, here on the coast, just these lush green lands that go up into the foothills, which look very much like this, just lush green trees, vegetation, grasses, whereas in the Judean wilderness there's not much of it.
Notice Israel, I've been there, I've lived there for 4 months, and it's like a good sort of junior training rock for the Israelites for the future expansion. The mountains are not Alps level and the deserts are crossable, and I don't know, when you consider the future of the Israelites going into Europe and the Chaldeans became the Celtics and going over the Alps, I mean, even eventually many centuries later, the Rockies, and it's a good junior training role. being a foot tracker or something like that. Those mountains are big, but they're not insurmountable. Everything's just on that level.
Boot camp.
It's not a massive
training. If you go up into the heights of the mountains in Lebanon, you get high mountains with snow, up in that sort of range. But you are when they come around. No, it's true. Yeah, there you go. Boot camp for Israel. I like it. Any other thoughts as far as how the land fits together, some of the connectors?
If I read the Bible, I see a place. And usually it's the back of the Bible, and as you said, you look up and down. So is there a place where you can where I can go if I read the Bible and find a place to have more like a detailed picture, not just a flat map?
Yeah, there's some picture atlases or picture, what do they be called? I think picture atlases of the Bible, picture handbooks of the Bible, and oftentimes they'll have more detailed maps laid out with the routes of, here's how they, went to and from. They don't always have as far as just the flow of the land, so some of these routes. So one thing that can be helpful to keep in mind is even if you find like on the flat map, you find a picture and you say, oh great, there's Arad down in the desert. Cool. So what? Where do we think about that? One can ask, how does that fit in as far as other trade routes that are passing through that area, kind of the big corridors, big highways? Where is someone coming from? Where is someone coming to? It's interesting, God often asks that question. When you think he meets, for example, Hagar in the desert, where are you coming from? Where are you going? Even more than just the identity of their location. Where are you coming from? Where are you going? So thinking, what from that point can you do? What can be seen? What can be grasped? Some of those picture atlases, those picture handbooks can help, because they actually have pictures taken by just a few now from those different areas. And you can see, here's the view that you might have. Here's the routes running in that area. I'd be glad I can recommend a few in particular that I think that do a very good job. Even the smaller book that this is from, Biblical Backgrounds, is an organization that has put together a lot of these maps in three dimensions to try and show the regions and the flow between them. Think through more than just this is now a place on the map, like you're saying, how does that fit in? How do we kind of bring that to life to understand a little bit more? So. it's a, you know, it helps thinking through the biblical stories, but it's important also just to ask what details are left in and what aren't. You know, there's some things that clarify details even geographically. You think, why would that put in there? Why did God include that in His Word? What can be gained from that? There's other things that really don't have a focus on the geography of the story, but all throughout there's at least hints and echoes of where stories get placed. So, but I'd be glad to mention just a couple of those pieces after. Yeah.
So where is Tyre then, or the king of
Tyre? Well, I think it's on your car. If I'm not right, that Tyre. We're right here. Tyre is here, that little peninsula coming up, and Sidon is this area. Where is Sidon? Sidon is right around this area. It's along the Phoenician coast. There's Tyre, there's Sidon.
Is that modern day Lebanon?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. Mount Hermon, that was the name I was looking for earlier. Here's the mountains that.
That's in Israel as well. Mount Hermon.
No, that's in Lebanon.
Is it?
Yeah. Israel ends now, right here. You can go up to the Golan Heights, and then it becomes Syria, and then Jordan here. This is the threefold division. There's Syria this side, Jordan down here, Israel here, and then up to Lebanon. So Tyre, that was where, what was it, Alexander the Great made the
bridge,
yeah, with tires, with rubble, you know, with all the stuff that he just pumped. Well, I don't know, not tires. All of the rubble that he loaded into the sea and made a bridge across to get to. But that was a major seaport.
Learning about it all the way from Dan to Beersheba.
Yeah, right. Well, that's a good question. So Dan is up here. Right at the foothills, it has a spring at Dan. Look for biblical imagery of the water at Dan, where you see descriptions of, you know, either Mount Hermon or Dan. Look at there's images also of the water that comes, the living water. There's the spring there. Man, what is the rate? I can't now think of the number of it, but it is a monumental amount of water from a freshwater spring that is, you know, that is released from that spring as well as one other nearby. That's right up here in the foothills of the Lebanon Mountains. And then so from Dan, that was sort of the northern end, to Beersheba is down here. Down here. So the Negev is the desert area. And Dan is up here at the top. So you've got this realm. So really from the coastlands, the lowlands, the foothills, the hills, the wilderness, and so on. That whole area, Dan to Beersheba, that's a common description. The whole run of the kingdom. So, and it used to take quite a while. You can drive today in a single day. Feels quite powerful. So that's the run of the land. Maybe if there's one last question, otherwise we can... let me see.
I'll just go back to the full map and answer this question of if the Israelites, Joshua and Caleb, took out all the nations they were supposed to, how big would the land have been that belonged to Israel?
Right. Let me go to the triangle. I think there's actually a map. That was the land allotted to them.
So the one who had failed to take out, like, the Sidonians and the Moabites, and where they kept them as slaves.
They lived there, but they were mixed in with those different nations.
Okay.
Yeah. So even down here in the where they come in, so they come in from, here's where we looked from the ridge line earlier, again, the two ridges, there's Mount Nebo looking over. When they come to Gibeon, even right here in the center of the land, the Gibeonites, they dress up as beggars and they're poor, they're beaten up, they come, oh, please have pity on us, great, thank you, we're actually your enemies, you didn't kill us. Got that one by. And you've now made a covenant with us, can't go back on your word, because you swore by your Lord, the living God. And so there's sort of an abiding there by the Gibeonites, but whether through tricks or by disobedience, they just say, no, we're not taking them out.
I mean, that's one of the saddest parts of the beginning of Judges. You read through, I think, chapter 2, and it talks about all these nations they took out, and they left some of them there, and they left some of them there, and they left some of them, and they left. And it was like in all of these different spots, they didn't do it, didn't do it, didn't do it, didn't do it, didn't do it. So you have this mess, and yet God uses it, even in their disobedience, stupidity, and their wickedness, and their, you know, God actually uses that to work this plan of redemption with the nations coming around. They who have defiled themselves as a harlot and, you know, married themselves to the gods of these other nations. Even in that, God comes in his faithfulness and says, I will not. You who are not my people will be called again my people. That's an incredible testament to the faithfulness of God to faithless people all through this land. I can show you that. Not afterward. It's in the States. If I think of it. There's actually a map that delineates some of the settlement patterns. And just from the archaeological finds, you can see settlements within the time frame that Israel came over the Jordan. And you just look at, there's nothing here that's found. There's nothing here. In fact, there's other Canaanite sort of artifacts that you find in these places from that era. So there's something on the ground, even in just the artifacts that are left, that give a bit of a witness to here's the spot. Yeah, they didn't take out that. That's seen. That's, we see these sort of artifacts. We don't see those, but all through the land they kind of missed that one. But let's close in prayer and any other discussion we can continue on. God of our fathers, we thank you that you are a faithful and enduring God to your covenants. You do not leave your people. Those who you have called, you will continue to work on until completion. That really is amazing when we think of how wicked we are and how prone to sin we are. How quickly we would sell ourselves to other pleasures, other gods, other idols. And yet, God, you have worked even in a people that was the least. You worked in them so that you would show your greatness. And so you would work even in us as nothing, that you would show your greatness. God, I pray that we would live in light of that truth, to surrender to you, to obey you, as Christ humbly obeyed you even to the point of death. May that mind be on our hearts. Thank you, Father, just for the pleasure it is to see how much of your word just lines up with what we see in the land even, let alone everything else. God, what a wonderful protector you are to your people who came in to fulfill the covenant you made even from Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob. And that you've grafted us in, God, that we can share. There's no dividing wall now. We can share in the riches of the inheritance of Jesus Christ. So we thank you. And it's in his precious name that we pray. Amen. Amen.